Hello, everybody, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Wesley Salmon. What's up, y'all? Missed ya. I especially missed that musical intro. It sounds great in the podcast, but in person, wow, it is just phenomenal.
Don't thank me. Thank Corey Gray, who is the composer.
Thank you, Corey Gray.
I think it's available to anyone to listen to on one of the free music sites. So I think
Spotify probably.
I don't know. He might have a Spotify page. I've never gone too much deeper into the Corey Gray catalog. Maybe we'll save that for another episode. For right now, you are of course listening to End Credits. It's a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movie, which this week will be the, I don't know what to call it, but it's called The Beach Bomb.
Yep.
That is in the second half of the show. For the first half, we are going to talk about some movie news from the past week, including killer doll movies. We have two coming out this summer. One is a remake of Child's Play. The other is Annabelle Comes Home. So which killer doll will win? And then the trailer for the Joker movie from Todd Phillips has been released, and it's been getting a lot of people excited about this Taxi Driver remake.
Mm-hmm, begin that buzz.
And then finally, Game of Thrones returns for its final season this weekend. We will talk about how things might wrap up for the Westeros gang. To start things off, we're going to talk about some more labor issues going on in the United States. This one affecting writers and agents. And it's kind of a difficult thing to get your head around, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so.
Well, let's explain. Unless you want to explain.
No, you explain it, man. You explain it. There's so many unions in Hollywood. It is wild.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like one of the last bastions of like labor organizing. But there's a guild, a union for the writers called the Writers Guild of America.
Mm-hmm.
And they are presently negotiating with the group of agents. If you work in Hollywood, you have an agent who's someone who like negotiates on your behalf. So and all the agencies are kind of as a group negotiate with writers. Mm. So called the Association of Talent Agents, and basically this helps leverage in terms of what sort of the baseline is, what agents can go after, and what their role is in protecting agents. Now, the crux of this problem is that agents have been enjoying unprecedented, shall we say, new success in the realm of package deals. So instead of negotiating, if Peter's writing a movie and I'm a studio, so instead of an agent coming in and negotiating Peter's rate to write a screenplay, this agent says, well, I also have a director. I also represent an actor. I also represent maybe another writer, so that they can team up and write this. And the idea is, instead of getting a percentage of what the agent would negotiate for Peter, the agent would get a lump sum from the studio for packaging all these people together, so they're in a position to make more money.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's... I was assuming it was probably the agents that got the... got the good side.
Right.
There is, lower agents who are just, the agents of, like, dogs acting and things like that. Like, there's some lower down agents, but overall, I think agents do get better pay than the writers, so I wish they were being a bit more polite to the writers.
Right. It's a
they
matter
have
of...
have a couple days, right? Or else it's...
Yes. Yeah. Technically, the agreement that they were operating under expired on Saturday. So, like, literally any time, and it could have happened before this episode aired. Basically, the thought was that the Writers Guild wanted them to end this packaging deal thing, or else the writers would fire all their agents. So you're talking about...
But that will just kind of negatively affect the writers, right?
Well, they're calling it the writers' Brexit. They're calling it Rexit.
See, I've been thinking about Brexit. It sounds a lot like that. So, what I've been thinking the whole time, too, is it's like way back in, 07, 08, maybe?
Oh, the strike?
The huge writer's strike.
Mm-hmm.
Ruined that one season of House for me. ruined Heroes as a whole, right?
I think Heroes was ruined before the strike.
I don't know. Halfway through season two was around the time it happened, and that's when it started. I think
ruining started at the beginning of season two.
Yeah.
But
and Lost, season four. Just 8 episodes? Those writers.
Well,
I just remember
all valid points.
I just remember it being very damaging towards what I enjoyed watching.
Which is important, but actually that strike helped establish
More rights for them.
Yeah, it was more rights, particularly in the area of streaming,
mm-hmm.
which in 2007 didn't seem like such a big deal. But now where you've got Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and YouTube producing shows,
mm-hmm. it's needed.
Apple producing shows, you know, there are more scripted shows than other. I mean, it was kind of like incredible foresight on the writer's part to, you know, really push for that, because if they hadn't, you know, it would probably be even worse for the writers in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are so many ins and outs in this.
It's up to the writers. I mean, sorry, not up to the writers. It's up to the agents, I feel. Because, like you said, they have more power and they need less from this.
Well, it's up to the agents, too, that are they in the business for themselves and sort of riding the coattails of the people they represent, or are they in it to represent those people? Because I've listened to a lot of writers talking, one of the things they point out is that in days of yore, you're an agent, you're negotiating on behalf of a writer or an actor or something, your money is based on a percentage that you get out of their contract. So it's in your fiduciary best interest to negotiate the best contract possible. But if the studio is just paying you directly, and regardless of who all you get signed on, if the money's coming, skipping the talent and going right from the studio to you as the agent, you really don't have any sort of incentive to get your
to care
client the best
the
deal.
Writers and such.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. That's why it's, I don't know, maybe the writers are trying, maybe they're maybe being a bit too optimistic. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I think it's unfortunate that what they're looking for is optimistic, but you know, realistically, those agents are—they're tough, and like you just said, they're in a good place right now. So I don't know.
Right. I mean, there's probably some
good agents out there, but I'm always thinking, you know, like Jeremy Piven's character and Entourage and such. You know, like people—they just—they want that money. Whereas, and I'm basing this also on media. You know, John Mulaney and stuff. I think there is writers who just enjoy it for the art. There is for agents too, but I think the ratio, there's probably more writers who care about the art.
Right, and not every writer is rich, and I think that's part of the problem,
exactly,
too. It's like, these rich writers, and it's like,
well,
no,
especially the ones in this little guild, or they're probably the lesser paid people. Unless, does every writer have
every
to
writer
be?
Has to be a part
okay,
of it.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. But the ones probably mainly involved in
this. So you have,
Shonda
Rhimes, and then you have, you know,
Shonda Rhimes, that's sick.
You know, people who are, you know, also
Aaron Sorkin.
Like, Aaron Sorkin, but then you also have like the writing assistants and the story editors. And,
but those are just, you know, that's a small amount.
But yeah, but the really rich writers are the small amount. Most everyone is like working class or you know, middle class. You know, they're making a good living, which of course you should if you're writing a TV show that makes, you know, millions of dollars a year for a studio or a network. I think part of the problem too is that from the sounds of it, the proliferation of packaging deals, which have technically been around for decades, is that it's kind of become more pronounced in recent years, but that hasn't been to the writer's knowledge. And I read one article where it quoted Meredith Steinem, who created a show called Cold Case. And in the later years of the show, she discovered that there was this $75,000 line item in each episode's budget that went to the CAA talent agency. And she was like, well, can't we cut that? And they're like, no, because it was part of this deal, because they teamed her with the guy who produced the show, which was also under CAA. So that was the package deal working. So here she is trying to, you know, find room in the budget for an aging show. She created it. I mean, it's debatable because of CTV's Cold Squad. We won't get into that. But, you know, here she is, like, trying to run a TV show, and you know, you have almost $100,000, and when you're talking about a TV show that's like a budget of $3 million per episode, maybe that's a pretty big chunk of change just going to an agent who's just sitting there not doing any of the actual work in creating the TV show, because 7 years earlier they had made this deal. So it's really sneaky too.
Well, yeah, but those agents, they've always been good at that.
That's true.
I mean, successful.
Right, and like I said, it's not a new thing. It's been going on for decades. And like,
it's never the writers that seem to fully win. I guess they
That's the other two, is the writers are always kind of on the low end of the totem pole, and that's always been kind of like the stereotype in Hollywood. You know, the screenwriter is dispensable.
Mm-hmm. There's so many.
Right.
So many.
So
they gotta lower it down a bit, what they want, I guess. Just I don't want that to be what they have to do.
Right.
But I think unless we want something huge, like, what was it, 08, 09, whenever it was.
07, 08, yeah.
07, 08, yeah.
I mean, it could be, I mean, to look at it another way, it's like you could, when you start negotiating at the halfway point, you have nowhere to go but further to the other side.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to start from the most extremist edge. And say like, no, if you don't like drop this, we will fire everyone. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's somewhere in the middle that they can meet now, although it doesn't seem like it. Everyone's kind of in their corners on this. But I mean, from the one side, the writers are trying to get more money, and on the other side, the production, the agents are, who have these incredible fiduciary stakes in these contracts, are fighting for their money, and they want to keep their money. And I guess it's a question of, who can you do without, the agents or the writers?
I don't know. I think agents probably do more than I think they do, but
yeah. Hashtag not all agents.
Yeah. Not all agents. But no, overall it's the writers that they need more.
Right. And it's, I'll make this the last point too, but you used to be like, you're a TV writer. Your TV show would run from September to May, and you could do like 22, 23, 24, 25, 26 episodes. Now, you're on a TV show, you're maybe doing 7, 8, 9, 10 episodes.
Yeah, there's more and more.
But you're still locked into like working for a whole year. Mm-hmm. So the more, business has changed in so many ways.
Yeah, more and more writers, that's worse for writers, right?
Sure.
Whereas more and more writers, it's better for agents, because they just get more people to be agents for, right?
Yeah. But and then that also creates more opportunity for packaging. But
yeah.
We'll leave that there and talk about something a little less wonkish.
Well, I'd say sad. Because if the writer's thing happens, like 07, I still have, I have nightmares about that. So I really hope they...
You still have PTSD from the 07 writer's strike.
Oh, yes, I do. I hope they get a little, a little something they want. But I think they got to lower it down a bit. Unfortunately.
All right. Something a bit more cut and dry. Annabelle versus Chucky. Who wins?
The film's not out yet.
Well, I mean, it's...
I would say based on the trailer, Annabelle's trailer spooked me more.
Yeah.
But I would say the Chucky trailer was more original. It was more...
remake?
No, I'm just talking about the trailer.
Okay,
because very first part of the trailer, I did think I was just watching, an advertisement or something like that. I genuinely did. So that was fun. And then it's like, oh, it's Chucky. I feel despicable right now. I forget her name, but Parks and Rec. She's
Aubrey Plaza.
Aubrey Plaza. I love her. She's going to be like the main character. So.
She's the mom and the child's player. Yeah, so it's Annabelle Comes Home, which was the third film in the Annabelle sub-series of The Conjuring. And then you have Child's Play, which is the remake of the 1988 Child's Play, which launched...
All the Chucky's.
I want to say 7 Chucky movies.
Yeah, there's a lot.
So, it's going to be a good summer for killer doll movies.
Mm-hmm.
I hear what you're saying about Aubrey Plaza, but I'm not sure Child's Play is going to use Aubrey Plaza her best.
No. The parent in horror films are also never... too centric.
Like, she's like, Aubrey Plaza's the one who can like show up on Criminal Minds and freak you out.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Legion, where she plays the Shadow King. And, she's like a really, really interesting actress. But I'm worried Child's Play won't use her to her best. Also, it was announced last week that Mark Hamill's going to be the voice of Chucky.
Well, I don't really. I didn't know that.
And I'm a bit worried.
I don't know about that. I don't
yeah,
know about
that. I'm worried that he's going to do just like his Joker voice.
And yeah, or
like,
something. Oh, yeah, he does the Joker. Yeah. I don't know. He also just The Last Jedi was phenomenal, but he just seemed a little tired. just a little. So I don't know if he'd put full effort into yes. being the voice for Chucky.
42 years after Star Wars, he's lost his boyish charm.
Yeah.
But yeah, he. It's one of those weird things where I feel like a lot of people are excited for Mark Hamill voicing Chucky. It's like, I don't know, because I'm like, other than, you know.
Other than Star Wars. Well, he's pretty regular in Robot Chicken, and he's pretty great.
That's
on
the
it.
Interesting thing, too, is yeah. that he did a he did Chucky's voice
about
on Robot Chicken.
I wasn't
Chicken.
Thinking about that. So, who knows?
He might pull it out, but I mean, when you're talking about the great thing about Brad Dourif as Chucky is that it's just like straight Brad Dourif's voice. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, he just has like a really kind of. I want to say normal voice, but there's something sinister to it as well.
Is this individual, is he still...
Brad Dourif?
Yeah, is he still alive?
Brad Dourif's still alive.
Oh, then they should have just got him to do it again. That or, I always forget his name too, but the guy who plays Rorschach in Watchmen, and he's in Shutter
Jackie
Island.
Oh, Jackie Earl Haley?
Yeah, he's always great in horror, so that'd be fun. He's got a creepy voice. He's got a creepy voice.
Well, he did, he was the new Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, I didn't use that as an example, but yeah. He's...
So I'm giving the edge to Annabelle.
Just the trailer, yeah, it spooked me. I think Chucky will be more critically acclaimed. I think Chucky's going to be like it. It's not that scary, but it's a well-received.
That's the thing
reboot.
Is, I think that it's I think it's sort of being itified or Stranger Thingsified. Yeah. You know that because the kid is the main character,
mm-hmm.
but Annabelle, it's set like. Kind of concurrent with the Conjuring movies.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the Warrens, Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga have some kind of role in it, like a supporting role. But also, like, the last Annabelle movie, Annabelle Creation, I thought was really, really good.
Yeah, they're all, and they still spook me. So I think for horror films, that matters. It is more a family-friendly horror film. Not for an actual like, young kid, but, like, go with, like, a group of friends or something.
Right.
Whereas, like, Annabelle, that's, like, a classic horror. Bring, like, a date or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And prepare to actually get spooked. Whereas Chucky will yes. be like, huh. Whereas Annabelle will be like, ah, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Chucky could be good sort of silly fun, but mm-hmm. I think Annabelle, because it's being directed by the guy who wrote it. And the movie version of it that came out a couple of years ago.
But Annabelle is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And he also wrote the first two Annabelle movies. Like, the first one is kind of blah, but the second one, Annabelle movie is really good. So, yeah, so stay tuned.
Yeah.
We might get to one and or both of those movies later this summer. Coming up, we will Ooh. Get to some predictions for the show attached to this piece of music. But before that, we're going to talk about Joker news, and we'll be right back with more end credits, so stay tuned.
My mother always tells me to smile and put on a happy face. She told me I had a purpose. To bring laughter and joy to the world.
Hey, stop them!
Is it just me? Or is it getting crazier out there?
It's just you.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey. I'm a Joker fan, so I don't know.
So that was a clip from the Joker trailer. It is a film that's coming up this October, being directed by The Hangover's Todd Phillips. I believe Martin Scorsese has some kind of executive producer mm-hmm. role, too, which is good because it's basically ripping him off wholesale. But having said that, I really want to see this.
Oh, the Joker? Yeah, me too. I think the trailer looks phenomenal. I think the Joker costume, I think that looks great. Probably not my favorite, but definitely not my least favorite.
Like, I'd say what a ringing endorsement.
I'd say it's probably my second favorite. I would say it's even better than
Ledger.
No, I wasn't going to say that. He's
Nicholson?
Nicholson, exactly. Yeah, I think it's a bit better than that. And definitely all the TV show ones. I don't know. Heath Ledger passed away, so maybe I'm just being biased. But I think Heath Ledger's is a bit better.
It's interesting. It does call to mind sort of like there are elements to all the Jokers in there. And I'm wondering how sort of intentional it all is because, like, the makeup is kind of very Cesar Romero.
Mm-hmm.
And the outfit is kind of Nicholson. The long hair is evocative of Ledger. Pretty much, like, everything's in there except mm-hmm. Jared Leto.
Yeah, well, I was just saying it's kind of in between Heath Ledger's really great subtle Joker, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's hardly any makeup or anything, just the messed up mouth, but not overly done like the Jack Nicholson,
right?
And not crazy and badly made like you just said, Jared Leto's. So I think all around, right. You know what? I think what's most important is it fits well with Joaquin Phoenix's face. You know, and it fits very well with his amazing voice as the Joker.
Laughing at the comedy club.
And that just that trailer, like the first part, him giving that little story, that was giving me shivers.
Yeah,
and you can tell he's going to be great as the Joker who truly thinks he's doing good. When he's no offense, Phoenix, but you're not. You're a bad man.
Yeah, it's.
And a bit of a story. I think this is why some comic fans are a little upset that there's going to be such an in-depth backstory. But I think that's right. Great. I think there has been some graphic novels that have done that for Joker. But
yeah, everyone talks about the Killing Joke, mm-hmm. which was kind of, in so much as the Joker has a definitive origin, it was that. But even Alan Moore, who wrote it, Alan Moore considers it one of his lesser works.
Yeah.
And I think that's because a lot of people consider it kind of like the Bible when you're trying to understand the character of the Joker. I find that one of the things I'm thinking about is whether the Joker, the movie, is going to sort of take comic book movies to the next level and in much the same way as Logan did, where Logan was... very much talk. I mean, it was nominated for an Academy Award for best.
Yeah, exactly. I think this Joker has potential for that for sure.
Right.
It's saying a singular something. Film. Yeah. Heath Ledger did win too, but I think this one has more potential for.
To be fair, I think Heath Ledger won because he died. But
yeah, I do think. Yeah, see, that's the thing. It's hard to view his in a fully kind of neutral way.
Right.
I do want to say Heath Ledger was phenomenal. I have literally just watched only the Joker scenes from it, but it was so Halloweened up, and it was so, his lines are so overused in memes and, you know, like laptop backgrounds and stuff, so I think the Heath Ledger one is a little dated, and that's especially why I'm glad the Joker now has a full central film. Suicide Squad doesn't count, right?
He's
in it for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So
no, yeah, it was I mean, one of them.
It's about time for like a film where
one of the many mistakes in Suicide Squad is how the Joker is handled.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's there's a certain timeliness to the Ledger Joker because I mean Christopher Nolan is making all sorts of commentaries about, you know, the war on terror and, mm-hmm. and things like that, which we've sort of outpaced now. What I find interesting about this is those comparisons to Taxi Driver, because, you know, when you go back and look at Taxi Driver and basically, Travis Bickle, you know, makes himself a character. He gives himself a mohawk. He puts on a costume. Mm-hmm. He puts on an affect. So, you know, how far is it to go from, like, I'm going to be like a murdering clown instead of being like, I'm going to be like a punk with a mohawk and, mm-hmm. you know, two guns. And it's interesting the feeling that connection between the two. And there's been a lot of YouTube videos where people have been like doing like the side by side thing just from like a minute and a half of Joker footage. But I strangely find myself excited about this.
Everyone seems one of those, to be, and I'm one of those. Yeah.
And I wrote it off.
Yeah. And I love all the previous Batman films. The Joker is always my favorite. So this one, Yeah, excited as heck for it. Also, I just want to say I really do like Todd Phillips. Yeah. And I think he proved
he's an interesting filmmaker.
And I think he proved with War Machine. Is that a War Machine?
War Dogs.
War Dogs. I think he proved with that that he can do a more serious film.
Yeah.
This clearly is a Joker. It will have some comedic elements, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Although it,
and Joaquin Phoenix, I love him, so I think it's phenomenal.
That's the interesting
thing
too.
His voice is perfect for
because
he's always kind of creepy and everything. Like he seemed kind of nice, but he's also
Joaquin Phoenix is one of those guys. Like, how would you get him into a comic book movie? He seems like one of those guys who would never do it. Like Ethan Hawke, like, you know, how do you talk them into doing something like this? And so it is curious. Like, what is there?
Well, I'm thinking
what was there
probably,
for him to appeal
probably,
to
probably exactly, and I think he has a good taste in. In you know a good film, so
yeah.
Probably read the script or heard enough from Todd Phillips or, to know that it'll be a Joaquin Phoenix worth film.
All right, we'll see. Now to get to Peter's favorite topic of the week,
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones comes back for the final six
on
Sunday on HBO Canada, and there's a lot to cram into six episodes.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, and it's only six. That is nonsense.
It does seem a little nonsensical.
They did put the amount of hours. I think the first one's like 2 hours or an hour and a half.
No, the first two episodes are like an hour, and then like
there's one that's like 2 hours, and then one that's an hour and a half.
I think the first two are an hour, and then the rest are like an hour and change.
Yeah.
And then the last one is an hour and a half.
Yeah. So I don't know. I haven't done the calculations, but it'll be close enough to the usual
Yeah, that's a good point. It would probably be, it's probably going to be a good 7 or 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's...
Including one episode, which I'm excited for, that's fully, like, a full fight.
Right.
Like, the longest fight.
Which
I don't think it's going to be, like, Helm's Deep level, but it's...
No, it's...
It'll be close to that, but it took them months to film it,
and I think we can pretty
much
assume...
In different locations.
Yeah, so I think we can pretty much assume that's going to be the siege on Winterfell by the Army of the Dead.
Ooh, yeah.
Which is kind of teased in
the trailers, 100%.
In the trailer that was released, yeah. I think people are maybe obsessed is the wrong word, but, you know, there was a little teaser that was released where it shows, like, Winterfell covered in snow and, like, it kind of messed up, like, mm-hmm. a battle happened there. But you see, like... Longclaw is there in the snow, kind of abandoned. The hand of the queen pin that Tyrion wears, and a lot of people are saying like, "Oh my god, does this mean Jon Snow dies? Does this mean Tyrion dies? Does this mean..."
No, I don't think they'd reveal that. So
right,
no, that'd be such an easy that'd be too easy of a reveal for them to do. So I think more so that makes it seem like, you know, maybe Tyrion won't die, or maybe one of those two that they hinted at will die. But no, I don't think both will. I don't think they're not going to reveal that in a trailer. They're not going to do that.
I think people are leaning into the idea that it's going to be like a bloodbath where almost everybody dies.
Yeah, nobody's going to get the throne.
Right. You don't think anyone's going
to
get the
throne? I don't think any singular individual is going to get the throne.
It makes me curious because I recalled the vision that Daenerys has like back in season 2 or 3 mm-hmm. where she's in the throne room and it's like abandoned. There's a hole in the roof. Like the sigil of the seven gods is broken, and so she's just like kind of wandering through, and it's like been abandoned, and I'm wondering like how does that relate to like her talking about breaking the wheel and mm-hmm. ending the great game and
since so many of them are going to be working together now, like the Greyjoys and the Targaryens and Jon, well, he is Targaryen, are together now, right?
Yeah.
So I think one possibility would be it ends up, this might be too lame, but it might end up being like a democratic place, you know? Like Jon Snow, he's the
right.
kin of Winterfell,
right.
That area. Greyjoys, they get their, you know,
the
land,
Iron Islands.
Yeah, and everybody gets control of the Seven Kingdoms. And then maybe in King's Landing, you know, they meet up together to deal with things. If not that, my guess would be Daenerys wins.
Mm-hmm.
She's the fan favorite. And then Jon Snow becomes the king's hand.
Mm.
Or of course, they get married. He's the king and the queen.
Which would be...
Yeah,
awkward.
There'd be a little... But they're just... Or are they cousins or what are
I
they?
I think...
Hey, it's legal in the majority of the states. So. And that's set in a different reality. So that's what they want.
I think... She's his aunt.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's a little weird then. No,
yeah.
I don't want that.
They're not cousins. She's his aunt.
Yeah.
Well, then her brother is his father.
Yeah, she gets the South, he gets the North, then. I think that's a possibility, too.
I wonder if Jon Snow has any role in the endgame at all, because what I find interesting is that we come to the end, or the beginning of last season, and pretty much all the power players are women.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Jon Snow's king of the North, mm-hmm. but the real power is Sansa, who mm-hmm. is technically full-blood Stark. You have
Daenerys.
Yeah, you have Daenerys. You have Yara Greyjoy.
Yeah.
You have Alisa Sand. You had Olenna Tyrell. So, of course, Cersei Lannister as well. Mm-hmm. We don't want to forget
Arya Stark.
Arya Stark, too. So, you kind of get the sense that it's a woman's world.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if that's
Arya's like the semi-aware or political. Like she's in control of the streets and stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She just goes around everywhere and can kill and such. And then Sansa's got the North, and
yeah.
Daenerys probably will have, the King's Landing.
So it just makes me, what role does Jon Snow have in sort of like the kingdom of women?
just his name, Targaryen. He's special as well when it comes to power. Like, he's dead, right? But he's alive again.
Yes, and that's the other
So there's things like that. I think a possibility is he was just reborn by whichever is the real god to help Daenerys or another one of the women that you just mentioned win.
So it's like a Starbucks situation.
Yeah, a Starbucks situation, exactly.
Where,
Jon Snow
Tyrion will turn
Starbucks.
And he'll vanish.
Yeah. Oh, Tyrion. Ooh. I think he's accepted he won't get the throne. So he's not going to get the throne.
No, Tyrion's a good hand. And I think that's where he's like excelled.
And he's aware of it.
Yeah.
He wouldn't want to be king, man. You can't.
No.
You can't. Well, you can't be a good king and do all the things he does, love making and wine drinking and such.
He drinks and he knows things.
Yeah.
Robert
Baratheon did do that, but that's why he needed to get Ned, right? So I Tyrion will be a phenomenal secondhand man.
Secondhand man.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you wonder then what happens to his siblings, because I think what has been set up for a while is that Jaime Lannister has to be the Queen's Slayer.
Yeah, I don't want that. I just want to say this. I love the Lannisters. I am a Cersei supporter and a Jaime supporter. And I really like them. So no, I don't want that to be the case. They love each other. I do want to say this on the I'm an only child, so I'm not able to view it in the same way as others, maybe.
You have extraordinarily optimistic view of sibling rivalry.
I haven't seen stronger love in Game of Thrones than between them. I just want to say that.
Well, it's true. I mean, people, for better and for worse, and mm-hmm. That's a point.
Yeah, I'd be totally cool if just the three Lannisters, just Cersei forgives Tyrion, and then the three of them just rule the world.
I find
that'd
that
be
unlikely.
Sweet.
I find
it's likely in my mind, but yeah, in the real world, it's very very unlikely.
Especially since Cersei betrayed literally everybody.
Mm-hmm. I think it'll be a woman that, either gets the throne or makes the decision to make it more, they're not going to use this word, but democratic, like I said.
Right.
The Seven Kingdoms more separated.
I think no matter what happens, it's going to be heartbreaking, because I feel like every death that happens is somebody's favorite. Like, there's going to be some group. Like, Littlefinger was kind of the last, death that had to happen.
Mm-hmm. Varys.
You think Varys is going to get
killed? What's her name? I don't like her. The fire, whatever her name is. She's Melisandre.
I am vehemently
against Melisandre. She made a comment that Varys is going to have to die.
That he has to die in Westeros.
Yeah, but I'm on
his
side.
She has to die in Westeros as he does.
Yeah, no, those fire people, they just got little tricks. The
Rohalor Lord of Light
lovers.
Followers.
They got, they just got little tricks.
She might be another one.
Siegfried and Roy do better stuff than them, right? You know what I'm saying? So don't listen to her, Varys.
Right, and I mean, this is kind of what's interesting about the Lord of Light people, is that they are, there's some, blatant, cultism and con artistry going on.
Yeah,
but
that's what they're...
There is still some power there, because...
Yeah, there is. There's been power proven for everybody but the seven gods.
Right. So, I mean, that will be an interesting... thing about, sort of what happens to her how she comes back into this, because and why and what happens, because, you know, more than a few people want her dead. Mm-hmm. Arya.
What so, I'm most excited for, Hound vs. Mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That could be cool.
Yeah.
We'll have to see what happens. Game of Thrones comes back this Sunday. But for now, we are going to move to the beach. And we're going to hang out with Matthew McConaughey. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
I've done a bit of smuggling, and I've run my share of grass. I made enough money to buy Miami, but I pissed it away so fast. Never meant to last. Never meant to last. And I have been drunk now for over 2 weeks. I passed out and I rallied and I strung a few leaks. But I got to stop fishing. Got to go fishing.
I bought a second boat. Yeah. Name is Success.
I just take tourists to the Outer Key. When they see a dolphin, I act all fucking stoked, right? Oh, it's a dolphin. Look at the baby dolphin. Look.
Tell them to dive in. Make sure they don't drown. I only have 4 deaths on my watch.
Only 4?
4 deaths in over 8 straight years of dolphin touring is a terrific record. Now, I've been stripped of my license temporarily on 5 separate occasions.
But each time I get it reinstated due to a technicality I never quite understood. It's beyond luck or karma, man. I'm blessed up, bruh.
Meant to be.
Yeah, I've seen many in this industry. They put on Captain Whack around these parts.
Nope, Captain Whack.
You will get whacked. You with Cap Whack.
And that was a clip from The Beach Bum. It is a new film from Harmony Korine, and it stars Matthew McConaughey, Snoop Dogg, Isla Fisher, Stefania LaVie-Owen, Martin Lawrence, and the one and only Zac Efron.
And Jonah Hill.
And Jonah Hill. Although that's kind of like a cameo kind of surprise situation.
I guess.
So, you know, when he kind of appears talking in like a Southern Mint Julep accent. And
he might have been in it longer than Zac Efron, though.
He might have been.
But yeah, the Zac Efron part was more central.
I wasn't keeping a stopwatch on it.
Yeah. Oh, really? Oh.
So, Peter, you wanted to review
I wanted to review. I'm a Harmony Korine fan, so yeah, I wanted to. And I wasn't feeling that Dumbo. Wasn't feeling it. And apparently neither the critics were. So.
All right.
Yeah, well, hey, Beach Bum, I, as a Korine fan, I loved it. I really did. I could see its flaws based on what the critics say, but I think if you're a Harmony Korine fan,
mm-hmm.
and you just you know what, here's this: if you're a Harmony Korine fan, a Richard Linklater fan, a fan of anybody who just doesn't care a ridiculous amount of the plot, just mm-hmm. wants a fun view of someone's life, or just a kind of real view of some event or sort of culture, I think it was a fun view. I think there were some parts that were very deep and dark.
Yes.
But I think those were needed to give a real glimpse into the Beach Bum. I think it's for the kind of people who are okay with not so much a plot, but it being centered around a character, an mm-hmm. interesting character, and just his life.
Right.
Yeah.
I think I've heard people, you know, mention shades of Lebowski in this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of it.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't surprise me if it's a Korine depiction of, yeah.
Right, like because, that. I mean, at the end of the day, Lebowski is kind of a guy who is, like, he cares about people, he cares about his friends, mm-hmm. and, you know, but he's, like, a man of small means. Like, he's satisfied with, like, what he has.
Mm-hmm.
The Beach Bum, wherein Matthew McConaughey plays this poet, beat poet, Moondog,
mm-hmm.
Who marries, who's married to a wealthy woman who dies, mm-hmm. and...
Minnie,
and in order to get his inheritance, he has to like finish a book.
And that's the basic plot.
That's the basic plot.
And you don't see him write the book or anything. They skip right over that.
Well, but I think that you see him in like tapping away at a typewriter at
times. All the ones that that he's not doing well at.
But then it makes me wonder, like when he's not like when he's kind of like wandering around the beach where's the typewriter and where are his finished pages?
Honestly, in his mind.
That's a good point. Yeah. Because I'm wondering how much of this is maybe in his mind. Because there's a subtle thing where, you can see it in that clip, although people listening couldn't see it. But when you're watching it, it's a single conversation, but one part of that, they're fishing off a pier, him and Martin Lawrence, mm-hmm. as Captain Whack. I had to say that.
Yeah.
And then in another part, they're sitting down smoking together, and it's cutting back and forth. So it's like they're having one conversation over the same sort of setups.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also part of that in one of the conversation that he's having with Snoop Dogg at his daughter's wedding, where they're having a conversation outside, and then they're having a conversation inside this like purple room where this magic weed is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same conversation happening in two different places.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always in the back of my head, is like, how much of this is maybe in Moondog's head?
Oh, I never really thought about it that way. I thought it was just Corinne wanted to make combos in different locations because it looks cool.
No, it looks cool, but it's the same conversation happening in like two setups at once.
You could also say it did that because it shows how much they love each other, like as broskies, that it's, you know, that conversation is going on for so long that it's happening in different rooms.
Right, right.
But I never thought about that Moondog idea, but I like that. I think I prefer viewing it, though, that it's all 100% real, and that's just the Moondog's life.
Right. No, and I could see that, too.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like you said, I like that he's based on a lot of basic the Big Lebowski guy, like mm-hmm. you said. Also, Sean Penn's character in Fast Times at Richmond High.
Oh, it's Spicoli,
Spicoli. Just a bunch of different people like that. I'm not going to lie. I think people that Harmony Korine probably identified with as a kid himself.
Except Moondog is kind of a sociopath.
Yeah, Moondog's Moondog. He's a bit of a sociopath. Harmony Korine is a bit of a – he just for fun the one time, just to get ready for the one film, he purposely got into a fight at the one bar and got like knocked out and broken, you know?
Good for him.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I think he thought Moondog would be a fun character. And how can a character be truly fun and interesting without some sociopathic elements? And it just the sociopathic elements also made him even more of a individual. Moondog's Moondog, man. Who's Moondog like? Can't compare him. Although we did, but so yeah, that's true. But I don't know if Moondog knows that.
There are these sudden bursts of like cruelty and violence, like when he pushes the tuba player into the ocean.
Yeah.
Him and Zac Efron like rob an old person in mm-hmm. like a scooter.
Hey, that was all Efron, man. You can't push that blame on Moondog.
Moondog
Flicker, that's
had
Zac
nothing
Efron's.
To say about it.
Yeah, but he didn't stop it.
Yeah. I think the technical criminal term is aiding and abetting.
Yeah. It could also have been done to show how even when you want to have a really chill life, like the beach bum does,
mm-hmm.
you might have to get into some sketchy stuff if you want it to continue on, right?
I do wonder if maybe Corinne is trying to say something, because I don't want to make everything in the world about Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
but there's a line in it where the Jonah Hill character says, you know, I love being rich because you can get away with anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's the message of this, is that, you know, the beach bum, Moondog, is rich and he can get away with anything, including, you know, basically somehow pulling a book out of his rear.
Yeah, but they skipped over it all, right? See, right, I liked that, because I was like, Corinne, like, don't worry, guys. This is a Corinne film. You know, there's not that in-depth of a plot.
Like, but it makes you wonder, though, like, how coherent is this? Because that's the other reason.
He was writing it in his mind the whole film. That's right. The way I kind of view it.
Okay. And just, like, at the end when he wins the Pulitzer, that's another thing that makes me think that it's all in his head.
All in his head?
That he manages to, you know, when he's writing, the typewriter appears, and when he, despite like all everything he does, he manages to come up with something so good, it wins the Pulitzer.
Mm-hmm.
Not only gets his inheritance, but it wins the Pulitzer and reaffirms his value as a writer. Because at the beginning, the Jonah Hill character who plays his agent, coming back to agents, is saying, you're practically worthless to me now because you don't write anymore.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunately the truth.
So not only
right?
does he get back to writing, he writes something worthy of a Pulitzer.
Yeah, I never thought about it in the way you were talking about it.
I just kind of viewed it more so as Harmony Korine wanting to make a film about some dude that's life is always fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Just some. I thought his goal was to make a film about a beach bum. Like, that's it. I Harmony Korine, one thing he said multiple times is he thinks of the music first, and then he makes the film around it.
Well, there's great music, for sure.
Honestly, he's the kind of guy where the idea you just said, which I think could be totally true, he might have thought that as well, but after he made it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just, it's got a lot of a current to it. But I guess that, yeah, it has a lot of things you can think about too. I just kind of thought about it. He's just a beach bum. He gets lucky. And, you know, maybe that's Corinne's way of saying, like, there is just people like that, you know, like, you know, maybe an allusion to himself, just kind of, you know, luckily, even though it's got like 26% gummo and kids, let him end up being ridiculously successful.
Right. Cause like he's made like deeply.
Yeah. And just he wanted to make, a fun glimpse into different kind of lives of the rich in Florida and I think California. Yeah.
It takes place in Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's made, I don't want to say problematic, the problematic's the wrong word, he's made, like, challenging films.
Yeah.
I think Spring Breakers and Beach Bum are kind of his most accessible.
They are. But, yeah, so. that's another thing I wanted to say. It wasn't, I would say, as blockbustery as Spring Breakers, but it did have it. This is just me. Maybe Korine fans. It had too strong of a plot for me.
Like it the had fact too
that
much
he,
plot.
The fact that he does have the book made and stuff like that. I do like that they skipped over the whole writing of his final book, though.
There are chapters to this.
Yeah, and sure. I don't think this is one of the Korine films where the music came first because the one we played was phenomenal. There was a couple that were a bit. Have already been overused by blockbuster films, so I was a bit disappointed by that.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, it was still like a very original film in comparison to everything else right now, including I'm going to start really thinking about your idea that it was all in Beach Bum's head. I like that, the Moondogs.
Right, because he sees his wife, Minnie, making out with Snoop Dogg. And what I find weird is he goes from there and he goes like to this mood pool and he wanders in. And he starts, like, sort of swimming in it. And what's weird is people around him start asking, are you okay? Are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, like, the first time anyone's, like, been concerned about him, even though he's done, like, some deeply concerning thing so far.
Mm-hmm.
But he goes into the pool, he starts swimming around, and then he walks out, and Isla Fisher is standing there, and that starts the course for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
So, and it's... There's also the scene where they're kind of like out on the town after that, and she's sort of like limp syncing to the Peggy Lee song.
Yeah,
and then it goes right from there. The Peggy Lee song is that all there is, and then that goes right into the accident where she dies, and there's just something kind of like really kind of. It's a fun little sequence for sure.
It is.
But all like watching, because I didn't know anything about this movie going in. I didn't watch the trailer or anything.
Oh, okay.
So I was going in, I knew there was a film called The Beach Bum and it starred Matthew McConaughey. But other than that, I went into this like completely open without knowing much. So when you're seeing this scene and it's kind of all dark with like neon lights, and that's another interesting thing is that it's very sort of like... Dogma 95 and sort of like, because a lot of it seems like very kind of au naturel, but as they're, you know, as she's like limp syncing to the song, is that all there is? It's fun, but there's also something, I don't know,
creepy about it.
Not creepy, but it, you know, it feels like maybe foreshadowing
her death.
Yeah, there's something like off about it that's made like, oh my god, what's gonna happen? Because I was expecting some sort of especially weirdo turn into like maybe like falling down territory. I don't know, where the beach bum kind of like goes completely cuckoo bananas. CFRU show Sunday morning, but but something to that effect. And what happens is she dies, and he's just kind of like, oh well. Smell you later.
Think he's kind of like that? Oh, well.
Yeah, I think he's like he's disappointed, but I don't think he's like feels particularly ruinous by this, because then we go into the next episode of him like trying to get money out of his daughter and going to the old house with the homeless people and trashing it.
Yeah, that's true. But see, I don't know. The daughter money thing, yeah, I don't know about that. But I think the homeless thing, all that, destroying the house, that could be his way of dealing with it.
Right.
He's the kind of guy, he's Moondog, he's an independent, and he reflects things and deals with things in a very different ways. But here's the thing. I do think he truly loved her. Mm-hmm. And I think, strangely, I think so. As Moondog, he did react more grandly later when he was talking to Snoop Dogg. And Snoop Dogg started talking about a time where Snoop Dogg and Isla Fisher's character, Minnie, started making sweet love. And Matthew McConaughey cuts him off. Matthew McConaughey is like a chill beach bum,
yeah.
But he didn't want to hear that. So I think that showed his love. See, there's little tidbits like that throughout where he's, you know, you get to learn a bit more about him, maybe how he views things and such, including what you said, the Zac Efron. That's the first time where you see Moonlight kind of, he did partake still, mm-hmm. but you can see in his face, he's like, this might be a bit too unethical.
Right.
So yeah.
It's interesting because I did pick up on that too because you think that maybe they're like in an open relationship or something that he would, you don't realize until he sees them kissing on the dock that like he didn't realize.
Yeah.
But he's been perfectly okay sort of.
And she was aware
on
of his,
her.
Yeah.
And she was aware of his, and you know, she wrote it off as like, oh, he's a genius and you got to kind of go with the genius and mm-hmm. sort of thing. So there's a little bit of, I think, commentary there that goes into the whole overarching, like, when you're rich, you can get away with whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're the beach bum, you especially get away with whatever you want. You can have relations with as many women as you see fit, but mm-hmm. if your wife is having relations with someone else while you're, you know, living in squalor in the Florida Keys, quote-unquote, writing poetry, then, you know, the shoe's, you know, what's good for the goose is not good for the gander, as the case may be.
But those are all strangers for him, whereas Snoop Dogg's also his best bud, right?
That's fair.
But, you know, it's 2019, so yeah, I do think...
it's 2019, everybody swings.
I do think that was unfair for Isla Fisher.
Right.
When it comes to my opinion and, you know, society's current view of that.
Yeah,
which is the appropriate amount.
Right. It's that's, you know, it's perfectly acceptable for men to sleep around.
That was another thing. It was based, you know, Harmony Korine. It was written by him, directed by him. I do think there was... Isla Fisher's role was quite prominent, but we mentioned it. It's you know, she dies pretty early on, and mm-hmm. there's not many. There isn't really any other centric female characters other than his daughter.
Yeah.
But other than that, yeah, it's more so him just making he's not making. Like, he's having sexual intercourse with them.
Right.
And
he's not celibate for long.
Yeah, and he's partying with them and such. So I think that shows that. You know, and I think that and his divorce with Chloe shows that Harmony Korine's, he's not modern.
He's not handling it well.
He's not handling it well when it comes to female roles.
Right.
But I think if you're a Korine fan, that's, you know, you're going to love it. A bit less blockbuster than Spring Breakers. But if you're like a Korine fan and like, you know, you love Gummo and stuff, you got to realize this is a bit more blockbuster.
Right. I think it's a tired old trope about women who have to die in order to change their man or women.
But he doesn't change.
I mean, so that lampshades it, right?
Exactly,
because it doesn't change him at all.
I think if it was another film, yeah, that's exactly what would have happened.
Right.
But no, Beach Bum stays the same and he just gets lucky. He gets lucky with everything going on.
Beach bum is beach bum.
Yeah, exactly. That's, yeah.
So there you go.
And we both seem to view it in a very different way, too. So I think, you know, anybody going. And the ending, too, is it leaves not a lot of questions, but a lot of different ways to view him.
Yes.
I found.
The whole idea about it taking place in his head, I think, is helped by the ending. But... we'll leave that there. I think it's an interesting film to watch. It won't be to everyone's taste.
Yeah,
but
if you're just like a blockbuster lover, you know, like, you know, Avengers and stuff, you know, this probably won't be for you. But if you like indie films, you like Korine films, you like just kind of, you know, Richard Linklater style films, films that are more centered on the character or the environment than, you know, the crazy plot happening, I think you will genuinely really enjoy The Beach Bum.
And having said that, we hope you come back next week for our Shazam review.
Ooh.
Speaking of blockbusters. Anyway, that is
it. It's like an indie blockbuster, Shazam.
Well, we'll see. I'll have to watch the movie first. That's it for this week's edition of End Credits. We hope you like it. And if you do like it, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. Find us on social media at Facebook, End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter, End Credits Radio. Peter, where can people beach bum with you?
As per usual, and I already have tweeted about it. I love beach bum. Mr. Talrak, YouTube and the Twitter.
Smash that subscribe button.
Mm-hmm.
I can be found tomorrow on CFRU at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out my political site, guelphpolitico.ca. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will, of course, be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more End Credits, and we will see you then.